Welcome to Cuke Audio Podcast, a presentation of Cuke Archives, preserving the legacy of Shunyu Suzuki and those whose paths crossed his. And anything else that comes to mind. My name is David Chadwick, and I'm the poobah of Cuke Archives. I'm speaking to you from Sanur with Doggett, Bandita, and Feline Cuchita at my side. Dear Katrinka is in America, and no plane's gonna land here with her for a while. So I appreciate your being here to keep me company in my self-isolation. Before we go any further, I must thank our sponsor. This program is brought to you through the generous support of you, our dear listeners. We are most grateful. Thank you. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. I hope that you and your loved ones are safe and comfortable in some fashion of self-isolation. I would imagine I am. Inserting this message at exactly 2 minutes and 2 seconds from the beginning of this podcast entitled The Introduction to Crooked Cucumber, The Life and Zen Teaching of Shunyu Suzuki, with some news from home here in Bali. Next is that news, the ramblings from Bali, and that takes up more time than the introduction to Crooked Cucumber. Now, if you want to skip it and get straight into the Zen stuff, pay attention. I start reading the introduction at exactly 25 minutes into the podcast, and you have my permission and blessing to go straight there. That takes 15 minutes and leads into the dramatic closing words and music, which tapers off into nothingness at 43 minutes. I'm at home in Bali. My wife's in America with her son and family in Oregon. She's near a beach. She can walk to the beach. She's not hanging out with other people. She's being careful. They all are. And I am too. I'll tell you what I do. We have a housekeeper, which we're required to have by law as foreigners living here. And she comes. Now she just comes twice a week for a few hours. She was coming 3 times a week, but it's just me alone. And she opens the gate and comes in, goes straight to the kitchen, washes her hands with soap for at least 20 seconds, goes back outside, picks up the spray bottle with an alcohol solution, and sprays everything she touched. And she usually brings me some fruit or coconut water, fresh coconut water that has just been obtained from the coconut, and some coconut shell. I like it from the older coconuts with the hard shell that you can eat the crunchy coconut meat. Generally, coconut water here is drunk, if it's drunk from the coconut, they call it Kalapa Muda, young coconut. It's drunk from the larger ones with the whole big green shell, and it's the slimy younger meat inside. That's okay, too. You can eat it. You can get a long spoon and eat that, or they'll open it up for you. But she brings it to me in these food-grade plastic containers that have snap-on lids. You can turn them upside down. And, you know, not always, but enough. And that has a lot of electrolytes, and I like it a lot. That's one of the things I think of I would hate to leave here, because there's no comparison to fresh coconut water and the packaged stuff. They sell a lot of the packaged stuff here. Somebody just gave me a bunch, and I drank it. It was good, but I love the fresh stuff. If I go out, if I go to the beach and go swimming, I don't hang out. I never hang out in the sun. I'll go to the beach and go swimming, and then I'll sit, either I'll go straight home or I'll sit somewhere and work on my computer. And my favorite thing to get is coconut water. We don't drink alcohol, which is one of the big things here. Bintang beer, Star. Bintang is Star. Star beer. And people like it. People who like beer like Bintang. It's very popular. I have one friend who comes over to visit, who's an old friend of my wife's and mine. No, an old friend from here, a few years, 6 years. And, yeah, she's really interesting. She wrote a book called Diving in Indonesia. Let's see what it's called. Oop, I don't see. Diving in Indonesia. I had it a minute ago. Yeah, Diving in Indonesia, The Ultimate Guide to the World's Best Dive by Sarah Wormald. I never say her last name. I probably mispronounced it. She's from England. Anyway, she'll come over and she'll do the same sort of thing Cadet does. You know, every once in a while somebody will come over. They'd stay with a mask on out in the courtyard and talk to me. We're not messing around. Now, a lot of the Balinese are, and it's hardly hit here. Yesterday, I posted on Cuke Nonsense blog, where it's more like my personal diary. I posted about, you know, a map of the COVID-19 virus in the Denpasar area. And it said there were only 32 cases so far identified in Indonesia, and two deaths. Control tower here. Not in Indonesia. 32 cases of COVID-19 virus reported in Bali. And that was yesterday, the 4th. Today's the 5th, April. I'm recording this early. And today it says 35 cases. Then it says Sembu, that means healed, 18, two deaths still. Indonesia is 2,272 positive and 198 deaths and 164 recovered. And let me look down here and see if I can see. Nothing changed in our area. Okay. Four cases identified in Denpasar, which is by far the biggest city here. And it had down to the very small areas of Denpasar. And we live in Sanur. We live in North Sanur, Sanurakau. And it was the purple color, which meant there were some people there under observation. But it didn't even mean in a hospital. That was another color, under observation in the hospital. So we're being very careful. And our dog loves Sarah, and Sarah loves our dog. And we took a walk yesterday. We just stayed a distance. There's not many people out. And we went to the beach. It was like 10 minutes away. We entered first in a place where local people tend to go. You know, as soon as we get near the beach, we take the leash off Bandi. Bandita. We call her Doggette Bandita. But Bandi, we say Bandi. Going to the beach is one of Bandi's two favorite things. That and dinner. And all she gets is dinner. Unless Katrinka's here, then she gives her some breakfast. But she's not that interested. It's just dry food for breakfast, dry and wet for dinner. And boy, does she get excited about that. But at the beach, she likes to run around. And you know, there's a walkway and little places on the right and left. And she goes in and out and goes into the water and wades in the water. Gets pretty deep. Sometimes maybe her feet leave the sand a little bit. And I'm not swimming now because I have to wait till the stitches come out of my ear. So she'll go into the water even if I'm not in it. She's really easy to take care of, and she'll always come if called. She's very little. They call her a Pom here, Pomeranian. I think she's part Pomeranian. There's a lot of dogs like that here. Anyway, we walk down the beach walk. There's a long beach walk here in Sonora. It goes 5 kilometers or something. It goes further than that, really. And we walk down there a ways. Then we get to the place where there's the hotels for tourists, and they're closed. They're closed up. They were putting, I mean, just a few days ago, I could walk through there, but they were cordoning it off, and they took all the sun chairs, and we're making a wall of them along the walkway because it's, you know, they're just little low bushes there and there. It's grass and stuff. So they're making a very clear partition there. And Power of Now Yoga, same thing, closed off. We were very careful. We keep a distance. She doesn't touch any. She knows what she touches. If she does, she points it out before she leaves and I spray it. So that's the sort of care we're taking here. And I think that's best. And like I started off saying, I hope you're safe and comfortable. So this is the second podcast for Cuke Audio. I got some feedback on the first one and some of my own thoughts on it. And clearly I'm going to be learning as I go in this. I've got a new mic. The old mic was good, the Scarlett C25. That's a good mic. But I got the podcaster's number one microphone, the Blue Yeti. I watched YouTube videos on the Blue Yeti. I've watched YouTube videos on all sorts of aspects of this, and they're very helpful. Since my wife isn't here, I can make a mess of this place. I took the bedspread off the bed. It's a beautiful Ecot from Flores. We've got some others I could have used, but when Cadet comes, she'll get one of them out. I wasn't sure which one to use, and she'll know. And also, since this one has been used, why not hang it up and air it? I hung it up behind me. I'm trying to cut some of the echo from the room. And I took out some more of these, you know, like a tablecloth, and he got tablecloth, and put it over the banister of the stairs. I've gone to sort of extremes, which I tend to do. So there'll be less echo. We'll see if that matters. The Blue Yeti, it's got these four settings, and I have it on the cardioid, which means it's just picking up what's right in front of it. And there's a couple of birds out there making noises, making beautiful sounds, recorded it without me saying anything while the birds are going, and then I listen, I can't hear it. That's pretty good. There's one of them, I don't know what it is. It's sometimes it reminds me of little Woody Woodpecker. That's the Woody Woodpecker song. But I close the doors and, you know, I close the curtains. I turn off the fans and it's hot. It's hot out there. It's 90 degrees. It was. And it's hotter this year. It's definitely hotter. 90 might not sound like a lot to you, but we've got high humidity. And I fear it's going to continue to get hotter. This house tends to be pretty cool. I work out in the courtyard a lot, and I have a ceiling fan above me. And I never feel very hot out there. I don't care what it is. And the courtyard's all shaded because there's these trees, mainly frangipani trees. And we get a lot of French bunny flowers, I'll tell you. Sometimes it's just covered in them. And we collect them and dry them. And we dry them on this thing called the bali, which is like a stage, a platform out there, which is a traditional part of a Balinese home that's used for ceremonies and events. And, you know, you can just sit up there and work and stuff. And Cadet takes the dried flowers and sells them. Now, you don't get as much as you used to. Years ago, they were worth a lot. But now, a kilo is worth about 70 cents, something like that. Yeah, she sells them, and of course, the money's for her. They're called jipun here. We don't call them frangipani. We call them jipun. There's another name for them in Cambodia. I think maybe jipun is Balinese and Cambodia is Indonesian, but I'm not sure. Everybody understands jipun here. So I sit out there on the settee, as Katrinka calls it, which is like a very firm couch with a carved frame. Very beautiful. I work mainly with my legs up, not with them crossed like you're sitting zazen, but, you know, comfortably. I can't sit in a chair too long. I can sit a lot longer with my legs crossed. But I have a little rattan table that I bring in front when they've been crossed long enough and I want to rest them, you know. I just stick my legs down and bring the rattan table over and work on it. And then every once in a while I'll tell Katrinka, there's a thermometer right there, and it's a fairly cool area there. It's not like if I walk out onto the street, I go, wow, it's hot today. But the thermometer will read usually somewhere between 80 and 90 during the day, well, depending on the time of year. So I'll say, oh, wow, it's 86 degrees, which is 30 centigrade. And she'll say, yeah, it's 86 degrees, but it feels like 95 or something like that. But it didn't feel like that to me there. We have a lot of rattan furniture here. It's very cheap and very light. I discovered this rattan place. Nyoman, the driver I usually use, who drives this thing called a Bimo, which is like a Volkswagen bus with an open side. He's been driving it for 31 years. He's a little older than a lot of the drivers, and he's a very important person in my life. Back when we lived in the Briar place, we needed some bookshelves. So he and I went to places looking for them. And there were all these places that had these really heavy wooden bookshelves, like made from boat wood and stuff, that were really expensive. I mean, expensive for here, you know, like $75 to $150. My God. So we just looked for place after place. And then we drove past this rattan place, and he said, hey, try this out. So I went in there, and it's this really tiny little hole in the wall. And these sweet people, this Muslim family lives there, a mother and a son. There might be two sons in this tiny little place. They live upstairs, and they have a shop there, and they make chairs, and they can make anything. So I told them what I wanted in terms of shelves, and we got all the shelves we wanted and some chairs and wastebaskets and things. It was all extremely reasonable, and it's so light. So that rattan table I pull over, I can just do it with one hand, you know, just pull it over, and it's just the right height for me to put my legs down. I get up a lot, incidentally. I don't just sit there for hour after hour. I work a lot, but I get up a lot, and I walk, or I do some yoga, or I'll sweep the courtyard. A lot of times I sweep the courtyard, social pressure. Not sweeping your courtyard right in front of your place is like bad form. They don't care how much plastic there might be elsewhere. But there's a whole big trip here about you know, like that kids at school will have a day when they bring these traditional, what are they, like straw brooms to school. They all bring one, and they have little cleanup days and things like that. But anyway, I'll get up and do something quite a bit. You know, I read in the papers? I don't get papers. I read online, the various news sources. Guardian and BBC and Al Jazeera for world news I like best. And Al Jazeera, I really like it because American news sources just concentrate so totally on America, which they're Americans. Why not? I read there, every now and then, articles on, and there's a whole trip on this, about don't sit for long periods of time. You know, get up every 30 minutes or get up every 40 minutes or at least a minute and a half or 2 minutes. So, yeah, I try to do that. Sometimes I forget all about the time and it's been too long. But I get up and walk around and do different things, or I'll go do some work in the kitchen or take the compost out or work on the recycling, neither of which are normal tasks here. But you know what I wonder is these studies about sitting, it's as if the only way to sit is in a chair at a table. And a great number of the people in the world don't sit that way. More and more they do as they pick up Western habits. But all over the world, South America, Africa, I don't know anything about Africa, but I know this is true in Africa, and in Asia, people squat, or they can sit on the floor. Harada Roshi, Shoto Harada, who I studied with in Japan, he felt the whole basis of Japanese culture was the hara, and that's a big deal in Zen and Japanese culture, and that sitting on the floor and living on the floor was the proper center of gravity, and as we lose that, society will fall apart. So what I wonder is, have there been any studies to compare people who sit with their legs up and with their legs down? Of course, I've been sitting on the floor, sitting zazen, or socially, for over 50 years. Good Lord, how long? 54 years. That's a real advantage, of course. And I didn't have a great deal of trouble getting into it. You know who had a lot of trouble? Was Richard Baker. Now, I wasn't there when he first came to Zen Center because that was 1961. And, you know, he's like tall and he was sort of thin then. And he said he had the hardest time crossing his legs at all. It was like really difficult. And he had to, you know, just to cross them in what they call tailor position or easily, he had to put cushions under his knees. And it just took him forever to get into half lotus. Oh, before that, he said he called it half lily. And I don't know if he sat full lotus or not. I can't remember, you know. And once you got robes, you can't see that easy, unless you're looking very carefully. And I've spent a lot of time with him. Like in 1973, I was what he called MJ. Main Jisha. I was his principal attendant. I was his attendant at Green Gulch Farm, but also when he traveled or, you know, I'd go to Tassajara with him and be in the city with him. And I always thought it was funny, you know, people would say later, he had three homes when we didn't even have one, stuff like that. Yeah, there were three places where he had a small area to himself. Like at Tassajara, you know, he had that tiny little cabin. And at Green Gulch, you know, there were other people living in his house. He mainly spent time in his office. And he mainly, in his office, spent that time in an area like, 5 feet by 3 feet, you know, surrounded by books with his table in front, sitting on the floor. God, they had... they had their own kids, and there was Sally, and then after Sally, there was Elizabeth, and they adopted a girl, and Renee would live there. You know, various people would live there. There was a very vibrant feeling in the home. It was fun to go there. And he could sit the longest time. Boy, had he learned to. And, you know, I've been with him in Germany and Colorado, and he can sit a long time now and seems very comfortable in it. So I wonder what he thinks about this. I'll ask him. All right, so that's enough of all that nonsense. And here we go with the introduction to Crooked Cucumber. Crooked Cucumber, The Life and Zen Teaching of Shunyu Suzuki, Introduction. The teaching must not be stock words or stale stories, but must always be kept fresh. That is real teaching. One night in February of 1968, I sat among 50 black-robed fellow students, mostly young Americans at Zen Mountain Center, Tassajara Springs, 10 miles inland from Big Sur, California, deep in the mountain wilderness. The kerosene lamplight illuminated our breath in the winter air of the unheated room. Before us, the founder of the first Zen Buddhist monastery in the Western Hemisphere, Shundu Suzuki Roshi, had concluded a lecture from his seat on the altar platform. "Thank you very much," he said softly, with a genuine feeling of gratitude. He took a sip of water, cleared his throat, and looked around at his students. "Is there some question?" he asked, just loud enough to be heard above the sound of the creek gushing by in the darkness outside. I bowed, hands together, and caught his eye. "Hi," he said, meaning yes. "Suzuki Roshi, I've been listening to your lectures for a couple of years, and I really love them, and they're very inspiring, and I know what you're talking about is actually very clear and simple, but I must admit, I just don't understand. I love it, but I feel like I could listen to you for 1,000 years and still not get it. Could you please just put it in a nutshell? Can you reduce Buddhism to one phrase?" Everyone laughed. He laughed. What a ludicrous question. I don't think any of us expected him to answer it. He was not a man you could pin down, and he didn't like to give his students something definite to cling to. He'd often said not to have some idea of what Buddhism was. But Suzuki did answer. He looked at me and said, "Everything changes." Then he asked for another question. Shunryu Suzuki was a Japanese priest in the Soto School of Zen who came to San Francisco in 1959 to minister to a small Japanese-American congregation. He came with no plan, but with the confidence that some Westerners would embrace the essential practice of Buddhism as he had learned it from his teachers. He had a way with things. Plants, rocks, robes, furniture, walking, sitting, a way that gave a hint of how to be comfortable in the world. He had a way with people that drew them to him, a way with words that made people listen, a genius that seemed to work especially in America and especially in English. Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, a skillfully edited compilation of his lectures published in 1970, has sold over 1 million copies in dozens of languages. It's a reflection of where Suzuki put his passion, in the ongoing practice of Zen with others. He did not wish to be remembered or to have anything named after him. He wanted to pass on what he had learned to others, and he hoped that they, in turn, would help to invigorate Buddhism in America and reinvigorate it in Japan. Buddhist ideas had been infiltrating American thought since the days of the transcendentalism of Emerson and Thoreau. At the World Parliament of Religions in 1893, Soen Shaku turned heads when he made the first public presentation of Zen to the West. His disciple and translator, D.T. Suzuki, became a great bridge from the East, teaching at Harvard and Columbia and publishing dozens of widely read books on Buddhism in English. When confused with D.T. Suzuki, Shunryu Suzuki would say, "No, he's the big Suzuki. I'm the little Suzuki." The first small groups to study and meditate gathered with Shigetsu Sasaki on the East Coast and Nyogen Senzaki on the West. Books informed by Buddhism, by Hermann Hesse, Ezra Pound, and the Beat Writers, were discussed in the coffee houses of New York and San Francisco and by college kids in Ohio and Texas. Alan Watts, the brilliant communicator, further enthused and informed a generation that hungered for new directions. Into this scene walked Shunryu Suzuki, who embodied and exemplified what had been for Westerners an almost entirely intellectual interest. He brought with him a focus on daily zazen, Zen meditation, and what he called practice, zazen extending into all activity. He had a fresh approach to living and talking about life, enormous energy, formidable presence, an infectious sense of humor, and a dash of mischief. From the time he was a new monk at age 13, Suzuki's master, Gyokujun Soen Suzuki, called him Crooked Cucumber. In this case, crooked cucumbers were the useless, tiny, bent, runt cucumbers at the end of the spiraling vine. Soen told Suzuki he felt sorry for him because he would never have any good disciples. For a long time, it looked as though Soen was right. Then, Crooked Cucumber fulfilled a lifelong dream. He came to America, where he had many students, and died in the full bloom of what he had come to do. His 12 and a half years here profoundly changed his life and the lives of many others. On a mild Tuesday afternoon in August of 1993, I had an appointment with Shunryu Suzuki's widow of almost 22 years, Mitsu Suzuki. Walking up the central steps to the second floor of the San Francisco Zen Center's three-story red brick building, I passed the founder's alcove, dedicated to Shunryu Suzuki. It is dominated by an almost life-size statue of him carved by an old Japanese sculptor out of a blonde cypress stump from the Bolinas Lagoon. "Hi, Roshi. Bye, Roshi," I muttered, bowing quickly as I went by. Mitsu Suzuki Sensei was the person on my mind. We had been close, but I hadn't seen her much in recent years. Soon, she would move back across the Pacific for good. I was a little nervous. I needed to talk to her, and although there wouldn't be much time, I didn't want to rush it. What I sought was her blessing. "Come in, David," she said in her sweet, high voice from the kitchen door at the end of the hall. I stepped inside, and there she was, looking strikingly young for the last year of her seventh decade. "No hugs," she said quickly, holding her hands out to ward me off, then rubbing her ribs. About 15 years earlier, I had been a bit too exuberant in expressing my affection, and my hug must have bruised some ribs. I bowed, tipping my body as Japanese do, without joining hands, and said something polite in Japanese. She stood almost a foot below me. Her face was round and childlike as ever, her hair long, straight, and black, with just a bit of gray here and there. She wore homemade loose pants and a blouse printed with chrysanthemums, the same material on top and bottom, an earthy brown and soft blue. The tiny kitchen was filled with knick-knacks, as always, the wall covered with art, photos, a calendar. After some polite chit-chat about family members and a book I'd written, I brought up the purpose of my visit. Some publisher may be interested in... It has been suggested to me that I might write some on Suzuki Roshi, collect the oral history, stories about Suzuki Roshi, people's memories. "Oh, thank you for writing about Hojo-san," she said, with the pitch ascending on the thank. Hojo-san is what she always called her husband. Hojo is the abbot of a temple. "So, you really think it's okay for me to do a book on Suzuki Roshi?" "Oh, yes, yes," she said emphatically. "Tell many funny stories." "Funny stories, yes, but not just funny. Serious and sad ones, too. Everything, right?" "Yes, but people like the funny stories. Mainly, you should tell funny stories. That will be good. Hojo-san liked funny stories. Everyone will be very happy to read them." "There may be some people who don't think I should do the book." She sat back down across the table from me and looked directly at me. "When I speak now, it is Suzuki Roshi's voice coming through my mouth, and he says, 'Please write a book about me, and thank you very much for writing a book about me.' Those are his words. I speak for him." It was time to go. She offered me a green metallic frog that fit in the palm of my hand. "Here, take this," she said. "It belonged to Hojo-san. He would be happy for you to have it. He loved frogs very much," she said, drawing out the first syllable of very. "I'm giving everything away. When I go back to Japan, I go like the cicada. It leaves its shell behind. I will do that too. I want to come visit you there and ask you about Hojo-san." "No, no, no," she said adamantly. "No more English. I will leave my poor English behind me." "Then I will speak in my poor Japanese," I said in my poor Japanese. "Okay, please come visit then. But keep your voice small when you do. Your voice is too big." "Okay," I said in a tiny voice and passed her at the door, assuring her as she instinctively cringed that I wasn't going to hug her. "Remember," she said, "tell many funny stories, then." "Why would anyone not want you to do a book on Hojo-san?" "Various reasons. You know, he didn't want anything like that. It would be impossible not to misrepresent him. And you know what Noiri Roshi said over 20 years ago?" Noiri was a colleague of Suzuki's, a strict and traditional priest, now old and revered. "No, what did Noiri-san say?" "That Suzuki Roshi was one of the greatest Japanese of this century, and that no one should write about him who doesn't know all of his samadhis, his deep states of meditation." "Good," she said, clapping with delight in her voice. "There's your first funny story." So that's the introduction to Crooked Cucumber. I had, of course, planned to have the commentary ready now, and I have been working and working and working on it, but I am not satisfied with it, and I am not going to subject you to it. So I'll have it ready for you next Tuesday. Thank you. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Well, that wraps it up for Cuke Audio Podcast for today. Thank you for joining us. Come back next Tuesday and we'll get together again. And if you want to help keep Cuke Audio going, just go to cuke.com, C-U-K-E.com, and there's a donate link up top and on the bottom of the page. I'll link to it from the Podbean page too. I haven't done that yet, and I said I would last week. We'd love for you to become a subscriber via PayPal. How about $1 a month? There is a minimum, though. It's zero. And if that's all you can set aside for Cuke, then just mail an empty envelope or blow us a kiss. We're somewhere out there in cyberspace. Take care of yourself, and don't let that nasty virus get near you or your loved ones. Till next week, I'm David Chadwick, the Poobah of Cuke Archives and Cuke Audio, with Doggette Bandita and Feline Cuchita, but without dear lovely Katrinka, wishing you a grand awakening.